You're listening to the Ask Drone You podcast. You ask, we answer your drone questions. Whether you're here to turn your passion into profit or you simply fly for fun, we're a community of learners and teachers who aspire to achieve greatness. We are
Drone You.
Hey everyone, welcome to another awesome episode of Ask Drone You. It's just myself today, but luckily I have the awesome pleasure of having John Rupert on the show. Welcome, John.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, always. It's always a pleasure. I know you've been crazy busy lately, but thank you again so much for coming on the show. It really does mean a lot to us, and it means a lot to our viewers as well. And it looks like we have a lot to go over today, from really the update on the John Taylor case, but also discussing more about 107. I know that we left you last time with some questions. We're hoping to get some answers and also discuss, you know, studying for this test. There's so much information out there. And even this morning, you and I were talking about a guy who had written an app where the information was just blatantly wrong. So we've got so much to go over, John. So why don't we just start really quick? And where are we with the John Taylor case? Why does this still matter? What do you expect to hear?
Okay, so currently with the John Taylor case, there are three cases right now, and they are all pending in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. And so one is challenging the drone registry that was created under Part 48. That's the first lawsuit. The second one is also challenging the FAA's interpretation of Part 47, which is the regulations that have already been created. They're already in effect, but the FAA has applied their, if you will, their discretion and not enforcing it at certain times, and then at others, they're basically flipping a light switch on. And the third point is that the FAA is also it's being challenged on the CFRA, the 30 nautical mile ring around the Reagan VOR, the DC VOR, that is also being challenged, and how they basically arbitrarily flipped that light switch on and said, no drones can fly in here. Oh, wait, back it up. Now you can, but you have to register. So that's also being challenged. Now, we've already filed the brief, and it's coming up, I believe, this week or next, that we're expecting to actually hear back from the Department of Justice, who's representing the FAA. They are going to be filing their brief, and then we get to file our reply to their brief, and then they get the reply to ours. So after that, we're looking at about a month or so when it's all said and done. It'll be locked in time, and then what will happen is that the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals is going to look at it, and they're going to rule on it. I wouldn't expect an answer from them sometime, probably until the winter is most likely what's going to happen. They're kind of slow. So the big issue there is whether or not the Part 48 registry will actually remain in place, and that'll
– So could you see if they remove the Part 48 – are we just going to go back to Part 47, or are they going to just have to rethink the whole registration process, period?
Well, here's the problem. If the FAA would have done it a little bit better, they could potentially have maybe kept some of it alive, because what happened is they violated two acts of Congress in creating it. So the big one was that they violated Section 336, which prohibited the FAA from creating any rule or regulation governing model aircraft. So that's the big one they violated. If they would have crafted the regulations a little bit better to say all non-336 aircraft have to register, well, that would be fine. That would have survived a 336 challenge, because it wouldn't be regulating anything falling into the 336 category. Now, the other problem with the creation of the regulations is that they invoked the good cause exception to bypass the notice and comment requirements of the Administrative Procedures Act, and that can only be done in extreme cases. You can't just create an emergency by your lack of planning and forethought and then go, oh, we have no time, we have to now create something real quick, so throw it out the door because it's an emergency, because people are going to die and these drones are all over in the skies and stuff. So that's going to be the big hurdle that they have, because the judge might, under the Part 48 challenge with 336, say, hey, well, in application, Part 48 does not apply to 336. Maybe we could try to save it. But even if it were to survive that, it's not going to be able to most likely survive the APA challenge, because we actually raised both of those points in the brief. So it's a good chance that the whole thing will probably get blown up, and then you're going to have to go and register via Part 47, because Part 48 will no longer be in effect. That's how it's kind of looking right now.
John, with, you know, the whole Taylor case – it really is still a can of worms, and it really could still have an effect on us in the future. But moving forward, Part 107. Everyone's talking about studying for Part 107. We've seen the 40 questions come out from the FAA. I've been creating a study guide, though, just for myself. And obviously, you know, we're going to be giving out to DroneU members. But it's almost 70 pages long now. And, you know, there are things that are in this test, John, that I didn't have to learn for my PPC license. I mean, so it seems like a lot of people are kind of focusing on the test prep, but not so many people are really focusing on, you know, what it means and, you know, how deep you really have to go into this content to be comfortable with it, to pass the test and really, you know, come over that obstacle. So, you know, what are you seeing? What do you think is important? Let's hear your reaction.
Sure. The some people have alleged that one thing I might want to respond to you is that the test that you did take the knowledge portion of the with powered parachute that you did take, do you feel that that was adequate? Do you think that could have been actually wrong? And then what the FAA is actually doing now is try to better tool under the ACS, the Airman Certification Standards. They're trying to come up with a better way to actually test people. They've already implemented this currently with the private pilot. And then they're also doing this here with the Part 107 exam. They're going to continue to phase, like scale that out. And what they're going to do is try to eliminate questions that are not applicable in the knowledge test, as well as include sections that are. So when people are kind of comparing it, I would say like, well, you're comparing an apple to an orange. They're trying to do it better and it will over time improve. Also keep in mind that they're trying to roll this out pretty quick. And so we're trying to crank something out. There are some opportunities they could have done better for some of the questions. I mean, primarily.
Are you saying that by taking the test early, you may have a better chance at passing the test because they may roll it out and evolve it over time?
That's a potentiality. They might make it harder, but I really wouldn't be focusing on that because not knowing how to read airspace is stupid for your bottom line. Because you need to be able to quickly, right off the top of your head, go, yeah, I can fly here. I can do that job. So when you get a phone call, hey, where do you need to fly? What's the address? Google Maps. Okay, go to Sky Vector. Okay. Yeah, I can fly there. That's not going to be in Class Charlie Airspace. I'm flying here. Or, oh, that's in Bravo Airspace, but it's just right under the shelf. So because what people do is it's kind of going back to when people always cite real estate and they're like, well, the drone market's like this, real estate. It's like, that's just this weird part of the drone industry. Don't look at that. Look at other areas. Same thing with Class Charlie Airspace is that they look at the basic shelf that's around the donut, okay? And that's pretty easy. Yeah, go to LAX, go to Miami, go to Orlando, go to Tampa, go to heavily congested airspace like San Francisco and figure out where you can fly. The shelves there matter a lot more because they step down, up and down. And so you need to know that much more so, especially over at Miami. Look at Miami International Airport and then look just due east and find out where you can fly because it'll step down. It'll go right here, you can fly, and I think it's like 1,000 feet and below, and then it steps down again to all the way to the surface. So you need to know how to read that because it's not uniform. It's especially Bravos in very heavily congested areas are upside down wedding cakes that were attacked by a bunch of a herd of toddlers. There's chunks of it missing and all sorts of stuff. So you need to know how to be able to quickly read that to make a decision on whether you can do that job right now or whether or not you need to apply for a COA and factor that into your time as well as your cost.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. One of the things that I've been telling people, John, too, is, you know, getting the 107 is the first step. The next thing you need to do is what airports in the vicinity of which where I live should I be applying for COAs to attempt, you know, to have that opportunity to fly. And just so you know, one of the things that's happened in the last few weeks, once I showed people the KBDU map, the drone map for Boulder airspace, other airports have now actually taken on that airspace map to say, okay, normally this is restricted airspace, but if you're a UAS pilot, we can give you an LOA and you follow this map. And it's something that is really kind of changing the way that we operate in airspace, which I think is really cool. So you've had, you know, a very real impact on that and how drone pilots are using airspace. But one of the things, you know, as you've mentioned, understanding airspace is very important, but also understanding special use areas, MOAs, alert areas, and even understanding, you know, the intricacies of airspace. Like, for example, you know, if we've got a towered airport in D and they're only open from, say, 6 a.m. to 11 p.m., but sunrise is at 4:30, and, well, we're drone pilots, so we've got 30 minutes of, you know, civil twilight before that, you know, are we technically in Class E airspace and ready to go, or do we still need an LOA because technically it's Class D when it's open? You know, these are the finite nuances that I don't think people really understand, and the more I've gone through this study guide, the more I've gone through this information, I am realizing that this is going to be a very difficult test, not only because of the content or the depth of the content, but the sheer amount and also the way the content is worded. They're very careful about how they word each individual sentence and each individual, you know, answer to the question.
I just wanted to back up briefly with the LOA. If you're doing a COA, you're going to get a LOA as part of that process. So the FAA doesn't want you to actually initiate that LOA discussion. They really want you to go through the COA process for purposes of they will actually take care of that for you. And that's how you get your COAs, because you'll be part of the LOA process.
That's interesting. I've heard that different ways. So thanks for clarifying that.
The people that you heard it from, how many COAs if they filed?
The funny thing is, I've got a buddy who's operating in Santa Fe. He's got a COA with Santa Fe. You know, KABQ would not give him a COA whatsoever. So, you know, he goes, all right, well, let's do an LOA. And I know another helicopter pilot that has just an LOA with Santa Fe Airport and no COA. So I've heard it. I've seen it done different ways.
You could do it. Have you ever seen the movie Rocket Man from Disney a long time ago? He has this great quote in there. He says, we could do it your way, or we could do it what we like to call the right way. you can do an LOA straight up and not fly under a COA, but then the FAA is going to be like, hey, where's your COA? Oh, you don't have a COA. Okay, so what good does that really do you? I would just be like, don't even go to the hassle, right?
Yeah.
Maybe it goes towards you not being careless and reckless, maybe. I don't know. But they're still going to violate you for flying in that airspace without a waiver. So I don't really know what that good that'll do you.
So let's talk about special operating areas and special things, because from what I'm hearing, 107 could only be the foundation of the house of regulations, you know? I don't know if you've ever seen the show House of Lies, but I'm kind of thinking of all the stuff they have to go through when they're consulting. But that being said, do you see other industries using 107 as a regulatory foundation and then setting more rules on top of that, becoming more restrictive? I mean, it seems that, you know, we've had this issue before with surveying, you know, where they're like, well, you know, you can be a drone pilot, you can create the map, but you cannot interpret the map because then you need a surveyor's license. So where do you see the evolution of drone pilots in specific industries with specific regulations?
Okay, 107 is going to provide, in order to be a competent, safe, and profitable drone operator, you're really going to want to think of this in a two-part setup. Getting your 107 certificate, that just gets you in the door. And then you're going to want to figure out how to actually specialize and focus on one particular to do it better than everyone else. So you're not just Joe Schmo, jack of all trades. So you're going to probably want to focus on some particular other type of training. So with doing real estate filming, you're going to want to find someone who has a lot of experience in real estate filming, or wedding photography, or cinematography. Maybe you're doing thermography. If you're going to do thermography, maybe you want to go to FLIR, was it Infrared Training Institute?
Yeah, and
go
that's run by
Thermography
FLIR, right?
1 certification. Because the thing is like at the end of the day, if you're just another drone dude.
Dude, I'm the drone guy. I'm
right.
The drone girl. Go to dronegirl.com. I mean, thedroneguy.com.
Right, so if you're just that guy, why would a large company want to hire you? I mean, think about that, because everyone's going like, well, I'm getting a 107. I'm like, wait, 107 set the bar so low that it's going to cause the commoditization of a lot of this industry. And people don't realize that you need to get yourself skilled in some particular area very fast and very knowledgeable, because if you're just a guy with a 107, if I'm a large company, let's say I'm a utility company, and then you approach me and say, hey, I'm you know, I want to work for you. I can use my FLIR camera to inspect your solar, blah, 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 my, your utility equipment to make sure that it's not overheating, or maybe there's no gas leaks in the conductors. And so I mean, it sounds like a great idea, but then the utility guys are going to be like, wait a second here. Like, how many private pilots do we have currently in-house that we can just harvest from, or we can repurpose certain people? They already made it through HR. They're already on W-2. You know, they've already had all that stuff taken care of. We can merely send them off to a drain training course, you know, like a weekend 107 in a box course, just to get them through. They already know the industry. We don't need to train them to know how to do utility work. We just need to train them to add them on to the, you know, get this little 107 certificate. So there's going to be some interesting problems there with in-house stuff for larger companies, because they're going to prefer to hire in-house people. And then once they've gobbled up all their people that they can get inside, then they're going to start looking out and they want to hire the most qualified individuals in certain areas to augment what they currently have, because they might not want to have full-time you know, drone guys in certain areas. You might be in a particular little region. You might be their little subcontractor that does all their jobs in that one area because they don't want to send a crew out regularly. They'd rather have you on call.
Another issue too that I'm learning with production companies doing more, you know, movie set and TV film kind of productions, they're not going to make you travel. They're going to try and find someone local. So you've not only got to have an in, but you've got to have an in with the local people. You can't live in Texas and try having accounts in, you know, Colorado and California. So I think that's something else, you know, another way that people can kind of adapt is, you know, focus on, you know, local municipalities. You know, again, you said what industry do you want to get into? Are you going to the association meetings? Are you going to those award banquets? Are you going to those networking events? Are you meeting the right people? And, you know, John, this is something we talk about in our book, you know, Living the Drone Life. You have to become really good at flying and then pick your niche and say, okay, I'm going to practice this thing, because, you know, part of becoming better is, you know, utilizing the perfect practice model, or essentially the deliberate practice model, where we're taking a job and we're systematically trying to eliminate the errors. Like, for example, thermography, you know, parts of the test are about flying by wire. And, you know, there's nothing about flying by wire in 8082G. There's nothing in flying by wire in, you know, the test questions, the sample UAV questions, and even the AC-107-2 or, you know, the 107 itself. So I agree with you. I think that education and skill are going to be ways that people have to adapt. But you have got to focus on what you're going to be good at. And again, I think at the end of the day, you've said it right. You've got to be really, really good at flying and flying video. You know, anyone can buy a drone and take pictures with it. Try making video with it, whole different story.
Right. I agree. And so then, I mean, with industries, you also have trade groups that have started getting into developing certifications. I mean, ASPRS has already, I believe, two types of certifications for their members that they're working on. So if you're in that area with
ASPRS,
I forgot even what the mapping guys, that's a better way to put it. I forgot even what it stands for. I'm like, it's the American Society.
That's what we have Google for.
I forgot. It's the mapping guys. So they have two certifications for the surveyors that people can actually take. So that's
American Society of Photogrammetry and Remote Sensing.
Oh man. Yeah, I'm like, what's the P stand for? I don't know. I'm like, I forgot. It's something like in aviation, we have all these terminologies and stuff. I'm like, I don't even remember what the thing stood for, but I know it does this. If you want this, you go there and do that. So they have come up with some certifications, and more as time goes on, that will happen. Maybe NAR, and so then if you're wanting to compete in those areas, you're going to have to comply with those. Because 107 is so low, people are going to start setting higher standards. And really, you need to look at 107 as being a very, very low safety standard. People are going to want to have people operating in a more safe manner. So, I mean, the large companies are looking at this going, wow, this 107 is just so liberal. Well, we ourselves are going to need to develop our own safety standards. So you could have a situation where the large companies actually develop their own safety standards. And that's what I'm hearing more and more is what's starting to, I mean, that's what's going on. So If you're going 107 is the floor and that's what you're trying to meet, that might be really bad for your bottom line at the end of the day. You might want to be shooting to be more professional and to get the skills and the knowledge to go out there and make more money.
Yeah, no, I agree. Now, one thing you mentioned that's really interesting is the associations, because now with 107, it seems like we're taking the drone world and diving in to manned aviation. You know, like it's like manned aviation guys are sitting at the top of the pyramid being like, climb the stairs, children. You know, like you got to do everything that we have to do now. Like you're going to have to comply to our standards on everything. So what does that mean for people like the AMA? What does it mean for people like AOPA? And I know we've had this discussion before. I am not even an AMA member after a conversation with you and a few other people. I can't speculate on how their membership is doing, but I would imagine not good compared to what I've seen on Facebook. That being said, people like me have been moving to AOPA because, you know, AOPA offers so much beyond what AMA offers as far as networking, notice of TFRs, safety information, continual training and whatnot. I mean, AOPA has so much to offer. So what is it going to do, you know, for AMA, for AOPA, for the MBA, AUVSI? Well, what effect is this going to have?
The drone community is realizing that they are part of the aviation community and that they need to adapt accordingly. So if you're going to face off on purely aviation matters, you might have a really hard time because the aviation community is already very, very entrenched. Now, AOPA and EAA with lobbying. What is AMA doing? Like AOPA and EAA actually do stuff. MBAA is the a really good commercial aircraft event to attend, and that's going to be pretty much the manned aircraft version of AUVSI. So most of these organizations are going to also start thinking, well, wait, we want to grab some more membership. This is a great opportunity to come in and try to pick up some of the drone crowd. So I see them starting to face off potentially in the manned aircraft guys moving in on the unmanned aircraft guys' turf. And then even with pilots, okay, just on an individual level, you're going to see, you know, pilots, commercial pilots, flight instructors, air transport pilots are going to start moving in, maybe want to make a little extra buck here and there on the side. The airline pilots who retire at 65 who want to teach flight instructing or do whatever, they might come into the sector as well. The only way you can really fight against those guys, because they have more experience in their pinky toe than most of the drone community combined, you got to have better flying skills, right? And better editing video skills, because at the end of the day, I mean, some of these guys they have horrible video. There's a lot of C-SPAN.
A lot of the manned aviation guys, you know, think of TV as it's, you know, Fox News from the 1990s. So I think that, you know, very knowledgeable drone guys who, you know, maybe they did their 333. They got some ground school, so they're familiar with the aviation community. But they also work in media, and they've been flying drones for 3 or 4 years now. I think those are the people that are truly going to be the most valuable. And I would see myself in that category. But, you know, one of the other questions I have is, do you see the manned aviation community becoming overrun just by the sheer volume of unmanned guys? Or do you think we're going to see a big wash of unmanned guys and then kind of a steep fall off? Because another thing that people are not talking about is the fact that, hey, we got to take our 107 test, but what about in 2 years?
Right. Well, in 2 years, it's going to, it's probably most likely going to be a lot more well thought out in the questions that they're going to be asking. So, as a current flight instructor, every 2 years, I have to actually go and get recertified to maintain my currency. And so what they do is in the recurrent testing, they try to focus on areas that they've seen as being problematic in the last 2 years. So if they see like a rash of, airspace busting, if you will, or TFR busting in the next 2 years. What's going to happen is that in the Part 107 recurrent testing, there will be an emphasis on having the recurrent pilots understand more about TFRs in airspace so as to emphasize the areas that have been shown to be deficient overall based upon maybe a lot of data NTSB has gathered or FAA enforcement actions or just what's being going on in the news. So that's how that's going to happen. The FAA is going to look back on the last 2 years and then start trying to emphasize the areas people are, you know, you work on what? The areas that you're weak on, right? So that's what will happen.
True. John, your knowledge is really helpful. Your experience is really helpful. And I think that being on the man side of aviation, you really have a lot of insight into what we're going to see with drones. And speaking towards that, you know, airspace is one of those things, like you said, you've got to know exactly, can you fly here? We've really talked about that already. But do you think there are any other concepts that people should really hone in on, things that people should really know well when they're studying for their 107 test?
Well, the two big ones right now that you're going to definitely want to know is the airspace, how to read that, and then also understand working near airports. Because primarily, in order to operate near Bravo, Charlie, Delta, or Echo at the surface airports, you're going to need a waiver. But if you're wanting to operate near a Gulf airport, okay, an uncontrolled airport, then you're going to need to know what happens in the flight pattern. You're going to want to know how to identify where everyone is in the pattern using a radio. Because so when I used to fly, I mean, we used to have tons of people on the pattern, and I could know where everyone is at any given moment just based upon hearing the chatter, and I can mentally map everything out. That becomes very helpful because some airports are near very expensive communities that might want some real estate footage. So you might want to get some footage in those particular areas. So you need to find out, where is that guy? Is he on the downwind? Is he on the upwind? You know, base, where is he? What runway are they currently using? And those
so
are
you have
very
to be able to read a tetrahedral. You have to know, you have to know about airports. You have to know about that. I mean, what I'm hearing is, it sounds like the way that drone operators currently operate and do their missions is going to drastically change, especially for those people who are not used to really following the rules, if you know what I mean. I mean, it seems like, you know, you're going to be operating CTAF, you're going to have to know about airspace, you're going to be talking about ATC. Before you know it, every Wednesday morning, you're going to be grabbing breakfast, bacon, and eggs with your FISDO guys. I mean, it really sounds like things are going to be changing significantly.
I think so. I mean, and I think that people who already have their pilot's licenses and have spent a lot of time at uncontrolled fields or towered airports, they'll have an advantage in knowing how to understand what's going on with the radio chatter to find out where everyone's at. So that's another thing people should definitely beef up on, is understanding patterns. How are they affected by certain times of the day? I'll give you a prime example. Let's say we were flying over at Pompano Beach Airport, which is just a little bit north of Fort Lauderdale Airport. So hot day, summer, noon, I'm flying out of there. If I'm doing a job, now this is Pompano is a Delta airport. You'd have to have a waiver to fly in there. But let's say this was a Gulf airport near the coast and it was a hot day. If you're right off the end of the runway, you're going to definitely be very, very careful as to how high you do fly. The reason why is that the high density altitude will affect aircraft performance. I had one situation one time where this Piper Aero I was flying on a hot summer day, the best we were getting was 100 feet per minute in climb rate. So we were pretty far out and we were pretty low. And knowing that, that's very important for people in planning where they're doing their drone flights. Also knowing the difference between, when does the traffic pattern go left and when does it go right? Does it always go left? Does it always go right? When would you have an example of where it would go one way or the other? And so what about helicopters? Which way do they fly? And is that different than manned aircraft? Fixed wing aircraft. And so knowing all of that becomes very, very valuable, especially if you know helicopter traffic's on one side, then you know they're going to be probably flying a whole lot lower than manned aircraft, the fixed wing aircraft, which are going to be flying a whole lot higher on the other side of the airport. So it's very important knowing how to get those shots so you can get the shots and make money and not be one of these goofballs that was flying the aircraft too close to the his drone too close to another aircraft, and then it gets on the news, and then more regulation comes.
Yeah, no longer is going to be, hey, you're the doofus who went on the news. You're going to be the doofus who went on the news, lost his license, no longer flies anymore, and you're out of the industry. So I think it's going to be a little bit of a different arena. But one of the points you brought up is density altitude, which brings me to today's 107 study test question, Mr. Rupert. What effect does high density altitude have on the efficiency of a UA propeller? Answer A, propeller efficiency is increased. B, propeller efficiency is decreased. Or C, density altitude does not affect propeller efficiency.
Well, what do you think?
I think it's B, propeller efficiency is decreased.
Why?
You're getting all, well, because of, with humidity and temperature, the way that pressure altitude and density altitude is calculated changes. And the way, you're putting me on the spot here. I feel like I should be back in ground school already. All I know is because it's hotter and it's more humid, it's more difficult for the propeller to make the same amount of lift, if I understand that correctly.
Well, okay. There's two types. Okay, let's back this out because drones are electric, right? So they don't operate on, they're not normally aspirated engines. So if you're flying, but like an Yamaha R-Max or a manned aircraft, you're going to have a normally aspirated engine. So what's going to happen there is with a higher density altitude, you're going to have less generally molecules in that particular given area. So then what happens there is you end up having less power output. That's why you have situations where you're taking off at Jackson Hole, Wyoming, on a hot day might be impossible for certain aircraft that are heavy. So what's going to happen is you're having less molecules in the air, and so that's going to affect power performance in the reciprocated engines and normally aspirated engines, unless it's turbocharged or supercharged. But that would be so cool to have a turbocharged, supercharged drone.
That really would be cool.
But you would have to switch over to a some type of gas engine, like a little weed whacker engine, right?
It'd be like a Subaru
turn it sideways,
drones.
Just you can trim your hedges and compete, make money. It'd be great. So
the sports that will develop are crazy.
I'll say it again?
I said the sports that are going to develop out of drones is just unlimited. So before you know it, you know those who can cut the tree log the fastest will no longer be done by a redneck, but rather a drone being controlled by the redneck. You know the wah. So that'll be a drone measuring the power of the servo.
Right, and so, but okay, so now in the situation for the propeller, so what you're going to be having is you're going to be having if you will less air molecules flying over the wing of the. When I say wing, propeller, that is a wing. And so that will actually decrease the propeller's efficiency in operation. Because it's electric, so you're going to have to look more for the theory of flight. I don't know really why they make weather theory. I don't know why they put that there for question 36. I think a better one might be like theory of flight.
Well,
like,
did you hear 37, what are the characteristics of a moist, unstable air mass? I'm going to say turbulence.
In Florida. You're in Florida. You're in Florida and there's flamingos down below and, you know, everything smells like pina coladas. So it's turbulence and showered precipitation. So unstable air masses, you're going to have a lot of uplifting action that's going on there. And, I mean, they say showered precipitation.
So hold on, let's take a step back. So uplift and downlift are convective currents, but wind is horizontal movement, correct?
Yeah, that's called advection.
Advection.
Which is different than convection.
Convection. So
advection, that's your like east-west breezes. And hey, going back to why you need to know all this stuff, in Florida, coastal cities. Great example. Looking at one of the figures on the test, it was a Class Charlie, and the runways were north, south, east, and west. If you see, you'll never actually probably see something close to that at a coastal airport. But what you can keep in mind is that with advection, especially in the coastal airports, the wind will tend to blow one way, you know, east or west, depending on cold front, warm front, if it's hot or whatever. But you can pretty much always bet it's going east or west, not north or south. So that also tells you what? It tells you that the traffic is going to be going east or west, not north or south. So if you need to get a job that's north or south of the airport, there's a potentiality that you might be granted that as a COA if you're needing to fly a Bravo or Charlie north of the field, because you know and you can guesstimate pretty accurately what's going on with the wind. So, hey guys, I'm trying to do a COA here. We will fly only north of the field provided that the traffic is going east or west. And you negotiate. That's one thing you can do. And that's what you need to know about weather, is so you can plan this out so you can have, you know, a bigger bottom line at the end of the day. So you can know, yeah, I can do that job. Or, hey, let me work on it. I think we can do that.
Yeah. By the way, I found density altitude in my study guide, which the book says density altitude is pressure altitude corrected for non-standard temperature. As the density of the air increases, lower density altitude, aircraft performance increases. Conversely, as air density decreases, higher density altitude, aircraft performance decreases. So I think that's a nice, succinct way of saying it. Now, John, while I have you here, is there anything else that you want to tell people about the test before we let you go?
I think that that people are going to want to understand the airspace operations. Just that's probably the big one right there. Is everyone's going to study 107, but you need to understand how to read the sectional chart and then understand how airports operate, so that way you know where you can and cannot safely fly. That would probably be the better one. And so, I mean, everyone's looking at the test here. I really think everyone needs to like move beyond the discussion of just let's study for the test. It really should be, I should read as much as I can out of the Pilot's Handbook of Aeronautical Knowledge, so I can take that information and use it to my advantage, so I can increase my bottom line. I mean,
that's where my study guide information.
Because you passed the 107 exam? Like, you don't make money because you passed the 107 exam. You make money because you know how to, like, deal with the situations that come at you so you can be legal and profitable. And so just doing the bare minimum is stupid for your bottom line.
Agreed.
And, I mean, that's what it is at the end of the day.
I could not agree with you more, John. Well, and by the way, most of my study guide information does come from the Aeronautical Information Manual. So there's a lot of good information out there. But anyway, John, thank you so much. We look forward to having you on again, learning more from you, studying more about the 107, hearing about John Taylor. Just so much going on. I know you've been busy. And for all of those trying to get a hold of you, I would say be patient. He's working on a huge project. So anyway, John, thank you so much for coming on the show, and we look forward to having you on next time.
All right. Thank you so much for having me.
And that's going to do it for us today, guys. Thanks again for listening to Ask Drone You. If the show has helped you out, for whatever reason, if it's provided value, you've learned something new, leave us a review. Give us a share. Tell your friends what you've learned, because maybe we can continue to help the airspace community, the drone community, and you and me together by changing perceptions, educating the public, and progressing the industry for a safe place. That's going to do it for us today. My name is Paul, and we'll see you next time.
We believe that videos, images, words, and sounds have the absolute power to inform, inspire, and entertain. We reject indecision, confusion, and vanity, for they work against the community. We are united under the virtues of safety and knowledge. We are a training community of learners and teachers who encourage and energize each other to achieve greatness. We are pilots, videographers, photographers, freelancers, business owners, enthusiasts, experts, and apprentices. We are creators. We are the Drone U.